Community Matters. Solutions to local issues and leaders who are making a positive difference.
Hey, it's Megan from The Morning Show on your encouraging WPER. Welcome to another edition of Community Matters. Today we have two great interviews for you. The first is with Dr. Sani. We'll be talking about the Lown Institute and the hospitals index that they just recently completed, which basically takes a look at the different hospitals across Virginia and how they are currently serving their communities based on a equal set of criteria. So Dr. Sani, welcome to the show. If you could just start off just by, you know, introducing yourself and a little bit about the Lown Institute, that would be fantastic.
My name is Dr. Vikas Sani. I'm president of the Lown Institute. The Lown Institute is a think tank in Brookline, Massachusetts, founded by a renowned cardiologist and Nobel laureate, Bernard Lown. And our goal is to develop bold ideas for transforming American healthcare. That's what we do.
So, Dr. Sani, then that's a pretty bold statement in itself, which is bold ideas to transform healthcare. So unpack that a little bit. What does that look like?
Well, we think the American healthcare system has a lot of room for improvement. And certainly COVID has shown us all exactly how there are, you know, various aspects to it, both in terms of disparities, but also just not being fully aligned with, you know, what the needs of people can be when they're sick.
Perfect. And then you said that as COVID-19 has shown you that the need for access to quality healthcare is important. What sort of things have you been noticing that COVID has highlighted? Are you seeing some specific areas where growth and transformation is needed?
Well, I think what COVID is really showing is that many hospitals depend on revenue models that involve elective procedures and surgeries, which, you know, while they're important and sometimes they're very important, get completely eclipsed when you get a pandemic like this and you get an influx of seriously ill people. And what we've seen is that hospitals that get flooded with sick people actually begin to lose money because the way the money flows is not really aligned with how sick people are. And even hospitals that haven't been flooded with sick people who have just had to slow down or suspend a lot of their more routine work, they've also been hit financially because they in a different way are really dependent on revenue that isn't about, you know, taking care of really, really sick people. So those disparities combined with actually where COVID has been hitting and how unevenly it's been distributed, I think together illustrate one of the fundamental problems.
So could I ask you then, from your opinion, if money were not a factor, how would our hospitals look different?
Well, if money were not a factor, and let me put it a different way, if hospitals really could rely, could count on revenues on the basis of the populations they serve, not on the basis of, you know, how many times did you do this surgery or how many people did you see. But if hospitals could really rely on that revenue, they could make decisions that would be much, much more rational and designed to optimize the health of the entire community. So I think that is a key thing. If revenue didn't matter, they'd be able to place primary care clinics in more underserved areas rather than competing in areas that are already well served. They'd be able to focus on things that matter in prevention and in preventing health crises in a way that they just don't have the time or resources to do now. Those are just two simple example.
In the research that you've done in basically comparing the hospitals, almost like apples to apples, you're taking the exact same set of criteria and then basically ranking the hospitals according to that. What are you finding in the state of Virginia?
So what we have been looking at is three things. We've looked at patient outcomes because that clearly is going to matter. These are traditional measures like mortality, readmission. We've also looked for the first time at avoiding waste, avoiding unnecessary tests and procedures, and we've measured that and are reporting that. And equally importantly, for the first time, we're measuring something we're calling civic leadership, and that includes things like pay equity, looking at how much non-professional workers in hospitals are getting paid relative to the senior management. We're looking at inclusivity, which looks at, you know, the racial, income, and educational levels of the patients that a hospital takes care of compared to the same demographics of all the surrounding community. And we're also looking at community spending, investments in the community that can help promote health in their communities. So these are the measures we're using. And what we're finding, say, in a place like Washington, D.C., is that, you know, for outcomes, Georgetown University does really well. But when it comes to civic leadership or value, they struggle more. On the other side, we have a university like Howard University that does really well in civic leadership and is not as good as in outcomes. And part of what we're noticing and seeing around the country, probably the major finding for us, is that it's really hard to do well in all three of these dimensions. But it's not impossible. There are some unsung heroes that we wanted to shine a light on, and we think they help us understand where we could go and how more hospitals could, in being like them, could go from really being good to being really great.
Now, I've read one term during just the notes leading up to this interview that I had never heard before. And so I'd love to just kind of get your take on these safety net hospitals. How prevalent are they in our area, and what is the role that they play in our community?
Well, safety net hospitals are hospitals that are designated on the basis of the number of patients or the percentage of patients that they take care of that are indigent, that don't have any health insurance, or that have state insurance like Medicaid. And that varies. All hospitals will have some proportion, but safety net hospitals have a disproportionate number of patients like that. So they serve a really important function. In fact, they're critical to the national health. And if COVID shows us anything, it shows us that we have to have all our hospitals functioning, you know, in top form if we're going to prevent, you know, illness and threats to health in any one place becoming threats to health everywhere.
So you mentioned that safety net hospitals have been disproportionately serve a portion of our community that is, you know, low income, limited health insurance. But have you also seen an impact? Are they receiving a disproportionate amount of COVID patients? Like, are they having to bear a greater burden than some of the more mainstream?
Yes, that's crystal clear. And that's because while COVID is an infection like any other, it can transmit to anybody. What we see is the concentrations, there's a significant disparity. This has to do probably in part with underlying pre-existing conditions that make people susceptible. But it also has to do with, you know, the work environment and the kinds of jobs that people do. So essential workers, people who are in transportation, people in the food sector, in delivery, these are all people who are much more exposed to the public. And so it's almost like COVID could be thought of as an occupational illness as well. So between all those factors, safety net hospitals have been absolutely slammed. In cities like New York, it was a horror show, and I think it's been well reported by many media. And I think now in Florida and Texas and Arizona, those are the big concerns that you know, this is, threatening to really spike up in a big way.
Wonderful. Well, Dr. Sani, thank you for your time. Before we let you go, if someone wants to find out more information about the research that the Lown Institute is doing, where could they go?
Well, they can go to lownhospitalsindex.org to look at the hospitals and the rankings, or they can just go to our main website, which is lowninstitute.org.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Sani. For our next interview, we're speaking with Caleb Marandino. He's the executive director for Advocates for Clean and Clear Waterways. And he and his team are actually doing some great work in the local region, trying to clean up our water areas. And they're relying on you, the community, to help them with that. So, Caleb, welcome to the show. Could you just kind of give us a brief introduction about you and your company?
So we're actually a team of two people. We're a 501c3 nonprofit. We've been around for about 3 months now. We've always done individual cleanups in the Fredericksburg and Alexandria area, but wanted to bring it to a higher level. So since for about, again, we've been around for about 3 months, we are now doing volunteer events in Fredericksburg, or actually in Colonial Beach, Alexandria, and Fairfax County. We've pulled out about 6,000 pounds of garbage so far. We have, again, we're a team of two. We've been to about 15 sites, collected about 300 bags, and we are needing a lot more volunteers, and we have a lot more sites.
So as a team of two, then, you guys are doing all of the work right now. Like, everything really just rests on your shoulders?
Yes, ma'am. Yep. So we're in the trenches basically daily, and then we have monthly events at those three locations, and we have a lot more. We have a volunteer cleanup coming to Fredericksburg, and then several more in D.C. and Alexandria as well.
So what prompted you to actually start this organization?
So unfortunately, there is trash everywhere. So we were tired of seeing trash. We know the local governments are slammed. Unfortunately, there are not many organizations that can keep up with the garbage as well. So we actually rely on citizen reports and then also observation as well. So when we see something, when we see a bad area, we go to hidden spots that are trashed. We get out there, we clean it up. And then we also rely on citizen reports when it comes to water quality and then also garbage as well.
So if I, as a citizen, am hanging out down by the Rappahannock River or hanging out at Colonial Beach and I see an area that's just maybe not too good on the eyes, something to be addressed, that's something that I would then be able to report to you guys to have that organized and cleaned up?
Yeah, absolutely. So our website is www.waterwayadvocates.org. We take citizen reports, and typically our turnaround's pretty quickly. We get out there usually in about a week, unless it's a severe incident or an urgent incident, then we get out usually in about 24 hours.
Very cool. And as far as volunteering then, I mean, you said that you need a lot of volunteers. What are you looking for in a volunteer? Are you looking for flexible availability? Are you looking for certain age ranges? Is this something that families could serve on together?
Yeah, so all ages are welcome. We really just need bodies out there that are ready to clean. Most of our events are about 2 hours just to make sure nobody gets overheated. And we have a good result from the last two cleanups that we did, and all cleanups at the moment, we keep in mind we want everyone to be safe, so they are socially distanced, and we do require masks.
So then you said that you have like monthly cleanups and stuff. So you do regular visits then to certain areas just for kind of maintenance. But in addition to that, you respond to reports when someone just calls in just to say this area needs attention?
Exactly. Yep. So for example, we were just down by Chainbridge, right on the border of D.C., at that location, we pulled out, I believe it was about 100 bags full of diapers and just horrific things that were actually floating right down the river and along the shoreline. And we do the same thing. There's an area in Alexandria that we pulled out, I believe, over 215 bags, probably more towards 250. So we go to a lot of horrible sites, but our goal is to find the small things, the hidden things. But again, we rely on citizens to bring this forward.
So what's the ripple effect then? Let's say that we're not paying attention to this and the trash just continues to stay. How does that impact our communities if we leave the waterways as they are?
Yeah, absolutely. So for example, Chainbridge, that area, when folks are leaving diapers down there, whether it be visitors, unfortunately, there's a lot of homeless folks out there. And when we endure those things, that we have truly sewage that is going, depending on the severity of it, we have sewage that's truly going into the river. Also, we have broken glass. So when folks go to swim, they get cut up. Wildlife gets tangled up in these things. I mean, we've seen it day in and day out. We've had to rescue wildlife. We've had to untangle them. So it impacts the wildlife. It impacts, of course, the scenery. It impacts the quality of life. And the list is endless, unfortunately.
Have you guys given any consideration to awareness for citizens? Like, let's say, aside from just the reporting of places that need attention, are there things that we as a community can do almost for like preventative maintenance? What are some things that we can do so that the waterways don't get this bad? And I know the obvious is throw your trash away in the right places, but are there any other things that we can do to kind of just prevent it from getting as bad as it does?
Yeah, absolutely. So cigarette butts is one of the biggest issues. Folks think that cigarettes are not, that they're biodegradable or that they're cotton. They are actually plastic. So when you throw that cigarette butt out the window or down on the ground, you're putting plastic into the environment, and it's actually really, really hard for volunteers to catch those. Mm. Everything that's on the street goes down into stormwater drains and empties into the water. So every single piece of trash that folks see, it does go to the water. Might take a day, might take a week, but it's going to get there.
All right. And then can you remind us again, just your website, your contact information. So when somebody finds something that they can report, how do they report it?
Yeah, absolutely. So best way to report it is online. It goes to both of us. It's www.waterwayadvocates.org. And again, that's for volunteer opportunities, donations. We are struggling financially as well. We are, again, a team of two, so we can only do so much. But if we don't have money, we can't get out there. But at the end of the day, we're going to get out there, even if it's from our personal wallet. So donations, opportunities online, and reports. We're here to help the community. So we actually are roommates, too, so we work around the clock.
Awesome. Well, Caleb, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate hearing about the work that you and your organization are doing. And I really hope that the WPER community can rally around and help make it a success, because our waterways deserve nothing less than to be clean and clear. Thank you again to the WPER audience for tuning in this morning. And if you'd like to hear any of these interviews again in their entirety, of course, you can do that anytime at WPER.org. Have a great day.